he was out for medical reasons one day in three. He also insisted that his mind was affected by alcohol and drugs. Later, he came around to the story that he had not even been living in his home at the time the bodies were discovered, and that the crimes had been committed by someone other than himself. In late 1972, Santa Cruz, California seemed like the murder capital of the United States. Every month there would be the report of another grisly crime, a body found here, a hitchhiker vanished there. There were more such reports per capita than in any other locality in the country. Residents were conscious of the murder epidemic. Many had bought guns, and security was beefed up at the campus of the University of California at Santa Cruz, from which several women had vanished. Later, it would be understood that three multiple murderers were at work in the area at approximately the same time. John Lindley Frazier, Herbert Mullen, and Edmund Emil Kemper. Frazier and Mullen were apprehended, but the killings continued until Easter weekend of 1973. The Tuesday afterward, at 3 a.m. on April 24, 1973, a call came in to the Santa Cruz Police Department from a public phone booth in Pueblo, California. The caller said he was Ed Kemper, a highway department employee well known to the police because he often hung out with them in the bar near the courthouse and in the town's gun shop. Kemper wanted to talk to a particular police lieutenant, but settled for the man on duty. He wanted, he said, to confess to the killings of various co-eds from the Santa Cruz campus, and to the killing of his mother and a friend of his mother's. If someone would come to Pueblo and pick him up, he'd point out where the bodies could be found. There was some disbelief at the Santa Cruz station. One of those on duty thought Kemper was just pulling the desk man's leg. But Kemper responded to some questions with more intimate knowledge of the details of the co-ed murders than anyone other than the killer might possess. While Kemper was still on the line, the Santa Cruz department contacted the Pueblo department and asked them to pick up Kemper and hold him until a Santa Cruz man arrived. When the Pueblo department went to the phone booth, they thought at first that it was occupied by two people. Kemper, at 6'9 and 300 pounds, was large enough to convey that illusion. 5 years later, when I first talked to Kemper, his size struck me right away. I had known about it, of course, but a man that big gets your attention. He stuck out his hand, shook mine, and immediately wanted to know if, in exchange for the interview, I could obtain some privileges for him and some stamps for his correspondence. I said I'd give him the stamps, but couldn't offer him anything else. Nonetheless, he was willing to talk and had pretty good insight into his crimes, having been counseled by mental health professionals for quite a while, and having spent part of his prison time as a clerk in the psychological section of the institution. He believed his crimes had been precipitated by his hostility toward his mother, who had been oppressive toward him, and that they had stopped when he had finally killed the source of his problems. That was quite a neat and precise explanation of a complex matter. So I asked Kemper where he thought he fit into the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, then in its second edition. He said he knew the categories, had read the book, but didn't find a description that fit him, and didn't expect to until psychiatry had obtained sufficient information to understand people like him. When would that be? When the DSM was in its sixth or seventh edition, he answered, and that wouldn't happen until some time in the next century. In answering in such a manner, Kemper was trying to tell me how unique he was, and was also reflecting the position of a leading psychiatrist who had spoken to him at length and written a book about him, and who thought that this sort of criminal came along about once in 200 years. I disagree. Ed Kemper, though certainly remarkable, is not so rare a bird. There are other murderers like him. He differs from them, perhaps, in the degree of his brutality and the depth of what he endured in his childhood. His size had always been a problem. He had become too large, too fast. He never had the opportunity to be a true child because he was large enough so that people treated him as if he were older. He did not have friends of the same age, and those that were the same size as he were years ahead of him mentally. His size was not an insurmountable obstacle to a productive life. The ranks of professional sports are filled today with outsized men who were once outsized boys, and none of them have become multiple murderers. However, the fact of Kemper's size was combined with the stresses of a severely dysfunctional home, one with an alcoholic and overbearing mother, an absent father, favored sisters, and a grandmother who was, in many ways, a worse nurturer than the mother. The mother would continually belittle Ed, tell him he was the source of her problems, and abuse him mentally in other ways. To me, the most telling event occurred when Kemper was 10. Without his knowledge, his mother and sisters moved him from the second-story bedroom he had occupied down to a spooky old basement room near the furnace, because he was too big, and they considered it unhealthy for him to be around his 13-year-old sister or in the same bedroom as his younger sister. They considered him a sexual threat to them. This shocked Kemper and brought his attention to sexual issues. Afterward, his fantasies, which had begun at an even earlier age, took a turn for the worse, now entailing bizarre sexual activity with his sisters and his mother, and the killing of these tormentors. From time to time at night, Ed would take a knife and hammer and slip into his mother's room and fantasize about killing her. The move into the basement at age 10 came at around the same time as his mother's first divorce, from Kemper's natural father. The mother remarried and divorced twice more between the time Kemper was 10 and 14. Each time, when the marriage was going badly, Kemper's mother would send him out to live with his grandparents on their farm, and he came to hate that. At the same time, on the farm and in his mother's orbit, he became familiar with firearms. One of his stepfathers was an expert and demanded that Kemper be a good shot and know about guns, safety, ammunition, and the like. As discussed earlier, the grandparents took a gun away from Kemper when he used it, as the stepfather seemed to be urging, to kill small animals. Such a confusion of messages characterized much of what Kemper had to bear. In 1965, at age 15, when his mother was in the throes of yet another marital change, Kemper was sent to the farm. He was miserable and felt used by his grandmother and ostracized from his schoolmates. One day, Kemper came up behind his grandmother as she was typing a letter at her desk. She had decreed that he must stay around the house and help her with chores that day, when he had wanted to go out into the fields with his grandfather, whom he liked better. He shot his grandmother with a rifle, then stabbed her. Having done this, he next realized that he didn't want his grandfather to see the gruesome sight, so he waited until his grandfather was approaching the house and then shot him, too, before he could enter the house. As if to make clear the connection between this murderous act and the source of his problems, Kemper then went into the house, called his mother at her vacation cottage, and told her that her honeymoon would have to be cut short because he had just killed her parents. Kemper spent the next 4 years at the Atascadero State Mental Hospital. During this time, he took dozens of mental tests and did well on them, possibly because he was able to find out the answers that the mental health personnel found appropriate. Later, he would let it be known that he had memorized 28 of the tests and the correct answers. In 1969, the mental health and correctional professionals at Atascadero State pronounced Kemper to be fit for return to society. He was, after all, still technically a juvenile. Over the objections of a state prosecutor, he was released to a California Youth Authority camp. The next year, at his mother's intercession, he was paroled into her custody, this against the recommendations of the parole board and of some of the psychiatrists at Atascadero. Looking back, I found rather amazing this parole of Kemper into the custody of the woman who had been the source of his problems. He lived with his mother and worked as a laborer at a Green Giant canning plant. His mother continued to push the justice system to expunge Ed's juvenile offense from his record as he neared adulthood. Though his mother had rescued him, she never stopped abusing Kemper mentally. "Because of you, my murderous son," she would tell him after he returned from Atascadero, "I haven't had sex with a man in 5 years, because no one wants to be with me out of fear of you." In terms of sexuality, Kemper himself was still a virgin, and remained so. During the years he might have experimented with sexual contact, he was in a mental institution, and became even more fixated on himself and his fantasies. At an apartment he rented for the times when he was not staying in his mother's house, he gazed at pornography and read detective magazines for erotic and violent stimulation. His murderous fantasies had not abated. In fact, they had grown more detailed and intense. Later, he would tell authorities that during his years in Atascadero, he spent a lot of time perfecting a method for disposing of bodies after he had murdered people. No psychologist had been able to elicit from Kemper this sort of information at the time he was an incarcerated teenager. My belief is that Kemper deliberately concealed the fantasy, knowing that to reveal it would surely hinder his release from custody. Kemper started work for the State Highway Department in 1971 and then put in an application to become a state trooper. Several law enforcement agencies turned him down, evidently because of his size, but he began to hang out with the police in Santa Cruz. One friend gave him a training school badge and a pair of handcuffs. He borrowed a gun from another acquaintance. He had a car that looked somewhat like a police cruiser, with a CB radio and a whip antenna. When he wasn't in that car, he was on a motorcycle. His state credentials, when flashed quickly at a naive observer, could pass for those of a state trooper. In February of 1971, while riding the motorcycle, he was hit by an automobile and severely injured his arm. He filed a civil suit because the injuries forced him to wear a cast for many months, and in December of 1971, he was awarded an out-of-court settlement of $15,000. The cast on his arm made it impossible for him to do the highway work, so now he had money and time on his hands. His mother had become a well-liked administrative aide on the campus of the Santa Cruz branch of the state university, and she obtained a car sticker for Kemper so that he could come on campus to pick her up after work. Helpful to students and faculty on campus, she seemed to take out all her frustrations on Kemper. Their relationship worsened. After one horrendous fight in the spring of 1972, Kemper slammed the doors of her home on his way out and vowed that the first good-looking girl he saw that night was going to die. The victim was never found, and Kemper was never indicted for that killing, about which he furnished few details. He did kill two young women on May 7, 1972, who were later identified. Both were Fresno State College students who had been to see their boyfriends at Berkeley and were hitchhiking to Palo Alto to visit other friends at Stanford. Kemper went after these victims, he later told me, because they were hippie girls, of the sort he professed both to admire and despise, and because there were lots of them on the roads. In other words, they were available victims who would probably not be missed for some time. That same summer of 1972, when Kemper picked up these two potential victims on the highway, a woman researcher named Cameron Smith was picking up female hitchhikers at Berkeley and asking them to fill out a questionnaire. According to a report of her work in Ward Damio's book about the Santa Cruz murders, Ms. Smith discovered that 24% of those hitchhikers she interviewed had been raped while hitching. Another 18% had been attacked, while 27% told her they had been subjected to attempted rapes or other perverse acts. Only about a third had completed their rides without incident. Despite these frightening odds, young women continued to hitch rides in the Berkeley area, and so, by the side of a major highway, Ed Kemper was able to pick up two teenaged girls in blue jeans who were carrying overnight bags. He had his handcuffs and badge, as well as a knife and the borrowed gun. Pointing the gun at the girls, he told them he was going to rape them and pulled off the highway onto a side road. Evidently, the women believed that they were not going to be killed and therefore decided not to fight back at first. Kemper was able to talk one girl into climbing into the trunk. Then he got in the back seat of his car, handcuffed and tied up the second girl, then stabbed and strangled her. He didn't use the gun because bullets from it could be traced. After killing the first girl, he opened the trunk and stabbed the second to death. With the two bodies in the car, he drove to his apartment, and there he decapitated the bodies and cut off their hands. At the apartment, he cleaned himself up as much as possible. There was still blood on the cast. Later, he'd cover this up with white shoe polish until he could convince his doctors to make a new cast for him. The amount of blood and the difficulties Kemper experienced in killing the women with a knife shook him, and he vowed that the next killings would be less messy. That night, he took off all the clothing from the dead bodies and copulated with them. Next morning, he realized that he had made at least three mistakes that could have gotten him caught, and he decided to proceed even more carefully from then on. As he had fantasized doing in Atascadero, that day he dumped and buried the bodies in several different places, the heads in a different spot from the torsos, and the hands in a third location. Anyone who found the torsos would be unable to identify the bodies because there would be no faces or dental work and no fingerprints. The burial sites were in a different county from the one where he had picked up the hitchhikers. He disposed of the victims' clothing in remote canyons in the Santa Cruz Mountains. The women were reported missing but were not found for several months. In August, the severed head of one girl was discovered. It yielded her identity, but absolutely no clues as to how she had died. By that time, Kemper's mother was lobbying hard to have Ed's juvenile record of the murders of his grandparents sealed by the court. The district attorney objected, saying they should be kept open at least 10 more years. A psychiatric examination of Kemper was scheduled for mid-September. 4 days before that test, Kemper went out hunting again. He picked up an attractive woman hitchhiking with her 12-year-old son. As he drove away, he noticed that the woman's friend who saw her off had taken down his license plate number, so he ferried the mother and son to their destination and then returned to the outskirts of Berkeley, nearly desperate to find a victim. This indicates to me that Kemper is a highly organized offender whose intellect is firmly in control of his compulsion to kill. He saw an Asian girl, a 15-year-old ballet student, and picked her up. Told she was being kidnapped, the girl became hysterical, but when he pulled out a new gun borrowed from another friend, she quieted, and he kept her docile by saying that he had problems and wanted to talk to her about them. Stopping the car just north of Santa Cruz, he smothered her until she was unconscious, raped her, then strangled her to death with her own scarf, and had intercourse with her corpse. With the body in the trunk of the car, Kemper then decided to go visit his mother for a while. It was strangely pleasurable for him to chat with her while he had a dead girl in the car. An important element in the growth of a fantasy can be discerned from Kemper's pleasure in conversing with his mother while he knew he has a dead woman in the car, just a few yards away. Here was something he would add to the ritual to prolong the excitement of the fantasy. The reality would never become as good as the fantasy, he would later tell me, but he kept on trying to improve both his performance and the elaborate nature of the fantasy. Among the topics Kemper discussed with his mother that night may have been the forthcoming psychiatric examination. Once the records were sealed, Kemper's mother had told him many times, he would be free of the past. Later in the evening, in his apartment, Kemper placed the body in his bed and again had intercourse. In the morning, he spent several hours meticulously dismembering the body, flushing the fluids down the drain, and afterward pouring Drano in the drain to remove any evidence from the system. Then he took to the back roads with his burden. He buried the hands in one county, the torso in another, and kept the head in the trunk of his car. The head was still in the trunk of the car when he went to visit one of the psychiatrists appointed by the court. That, too, gave Kemper a kick. Both psychiatrists who examined him in September of 1972 concluded that he had made excellent progress during his time at Atascadero. One of them wrote, "If I were seeing this patient without having any history available, or without getting the history from him, I would think that we're dealing with a very well-adjusted young man who had initiative, intelligence, and who was free of any psychiatric illness. In effect, we are dealing with two different people when we talk of the 15-year-old boy who committed the murder and of the 23-year-old man we see before us now. It is my opinion that he has made a very excellent response to the years of treatment and rehabilitation, and I would see no psychiatric reason to consider him to be of any danger to himself or to any member of society." The second psychiatrist added, "He appears to have made a good recovery from such a tragic and violent split within himself. He appears to be functioning in one piece, now directing his feelings towards verbalization, work, sports, and not allowing neurotic buildup within himself. Since it may allow him more freedom as an adult to develop his potential, I would consider it reasonable to have a permanent expunction of his juvenile records. I am glad he has recently expunged his motorcycle, and I would hope that he would do that, seal it, permanently, since this seemed more a threat to his life and health than any threat he is presently to anyone else." Since both psychiatrists recommended the sealing of the records so that Kemper could get on with his life, on November 29, 1972, they were officially sealed. After killing the Asian dancer, Kemper was able to keep a lid on his murderous impulses for the several months before and just after his juvenile records were sealed. With the turn of the new year, however, the urge to kill resurfaced. He returned the guns that he had borrowed from his friends and sought one of his own. Now that his records were sealed, he had a legal right to own a gun. He drove to the town where he had worked at the food factory and purchased a .22 pistol with a long barrel and some hollow-point ammunition that exploded on impact. That same afternoon, in daylight, he picked up another hitchhiker, a rather heavy young girl. He told her he wanted to talk, and she seemed sympathetic. Nonetheless, he killed her with a single bullet from his new gun, then drove to his mother's home. She wasn't there, so Kemper took the body from the car and stashed it in his bedroom closet. After his mother left for work the next morning, he dismembered it. Part of the reason for severing the head was to remove the spent bullet from it. That way, there would be no ballistic evidence to connect him with the crime. He threw the body parts over a remote cliff into the sea. Some of them were found within a few days. The head he buried underneath his mother's window. By this time, since Kemper and Herbert Mullen were both killing people in the area, many people had become frightened, and security forces were on alert to look for suspicious characters. Less than a month after killing the heavy girl, and after a particularly heated argument with his mother in February 1973, Kemper went on to the UCSC campus, picked up two young women, and shot them both before reaching the perimeter of the campus. The students were not quite dead, and one was groaning audibly when Kemper pulled up to the gates where two armed young rookie guards were manning the post. The men looked right into the car, but either did not see the dying women or did not understand what they were viewing in the dark interior of the car. Though the exterior of the car was a drab tan, the interior was black. The woman in the front seat, dressed in black, was partially tumbled over into the wheel well, and the one in the back was covered by a blanket that Kemper had purposefully kept in the car for just such an occasion. The guards paid more attention to the campus sticker on the window than to the moaning bundles in the car, and they let Kemper pass. For Ed, it was a moment of triumph. These bodies, too, he handled boldly when his mother was nearby, seemingly excited by the possibility that she might discover him doing it. He decapitated them in the trunk of the car while it sat in her driveway, and took the heads into the house so he could look at them in his bedroom. Masturbation would be a part of this ghastly ritual. He returned the heads to the car in the morning and kept all the parts in the car for the next day and more, driving the car to the home of some friends where he had dinner. Later in the evening, he dumped the parts in various places, again taking care to remove the bullets from the heads. There was a bullet hole in the car, however, and too much blood in the trunk for him to wash away completely, and other such telltale evidence. Kemper seemed aware of these matters and was a bit skittish. In early April, he bought another gun, a .44 pistol. When a sheriff received the record of the sale of the weapon, he remembered something about Kemper's early conviction and decided to make a check on it. Finding the record sealed, he nevertheless drove to Kemper's apartment and asked him for the pistol. He would hold it until a court decided whether it was legal for Kemper to own a weapon. Kemper opened the trunk of his car and, without an argument, gave the pistol to the sheriff. The sheriff was satisfied with that and did not search the car thoroughly, and so did not find the .22 murder weapon that was concealed under his seat. After the sheriff left, however, Kemper started playing what-if games in his mind. What if the sheriff had seen traces of blood or hair in the trunk? What if the sheriff found out about the .22 pistol as he had learned about the .44? What if the authorities came back and searched his car, his apartment, his mother's home? What if there was now a tail on him? Kemper later told the police it was then that he decided he must kill his mother and surrender. 2 weeks after the sheriff picked up the .44 on Good Friday, April 20, 1973, Kemper went to his mother's home. She arrived later, after a faculty meeting, and they had a brief conversation in which his mother was, as usual, sarcastic to him. Once she had fallen asleep at 5 in the morning, Kemper took a claw hammer from the kitchen and, as he had done so often in his imagination, went into her bedroom while she slept. This time, he actually brought the hammer down with considerable force on her right temple, then slashed her throat with his pocket knife. Blood was still gushing from her as he decided to sever the head as he had done with his other victims. Another slice removed her larynx, and he threw this part into the disposal unit in the kitchen sink. When the disposal was unable to digest the larynx and spewed it back out, Kemper thought this was poetic justice. He wrapped the body in the bloody sheets and stashed it in the closet. Later in the morning, he went to the bar that was the police hangout and to the gun shop and talked calmly to some friends, even trying to borrow a gun from one of them, who refused. That afternoon, however, he reasoned that since this was a holiday weekend, family members or one of his mother's close friends who also worked at the university might well appear at the house and discover the body. Taking the initiative, he invited his mother's associate, Sarah Hallett, to help him plan a surprise party for her, and when she arrived, he snapped her neck. He left her body on his own bed and spent the night on his mother's. Easter Sunday morning, he stuffed the friend's body in another closet, then piled his guns, the two women's credit cards and money into the friend's car, and took off on his final journey. Once in custody, he was determined to give the police the evidence they needed to convict him. He was convinced that they would never have found it on their own, and that if he had simply confessed and not led them point by point to physical evidence, a smart lawyer might later be able to discount the confession and enable Kemper to escape conviction. And so, in addition to confessing, he told police just where to find the bodies in his mother's home, and even before the public was made aware of these killings, led police to the dump and burial sites of several of the other victims. Still more evidence from the dead girls, a scarf, a textbook, and so on, was found in his mother's home, his apartment, and his car. Part of this evidence was obtained by the police by smart interrogation. They kept complimenting Kemper on his intellect, his powers of memory, his wonderful recall of detail, until he led them to such items as a blood-soaked blanket, with a contemptuous remark such as, "Here's another piece of evidence for your case." Awaiting trial, Kemper attempted twice to commit suicide by slashing his wrists and was soon transferred to a solitary cell. The trial itself was rather short. The evidence was there, and it showed clear premeditation. All the psychiatrists called to testify said that Kemper had clearly been sane when he had committed the crimes. During the trial, Kemper was asked why he had killed the hitchhikers. "That was the only way they could be mine," he said, and added, "I had their spirits. I still have them." Kemper was soon convicted of 7 murders and sentenced to death. Asked what he thought was the appropriate punishment for his crimes, he replied, "Torture." He got neither death nor active torture. Rather, he was put into prison, for although California had embraced the death penalty in principle, no one was being executed in that state at that time. In prison, Kemper calmed down and became a well-behaved inmate, accepted into the prison population, gradually given increasing amounts of privileges, if not freedom, within the institution. In our interviews, which began 5 years after his crimes, Kemper concentrated at first on the facts of the murders, in the process telling me a number of things that were of interest to law enforcement. For example, that he had rather consciously tried to have his car appear as if it was a police vehicle, and that he had broken teeth away from the heads of his victims in order to foil attempts at identification. He spoke of the killings in a matter-of-fact way, not to shock, but as if he had been over the territory a million times in his mind and saw it as something unconnected to his everyday self. No one other than a pathologist, he contended, knew more about dead bodies than he did. For instance, he was still amused that one of the medical examiners who had made a report about one of his victims hadn't understood that he had cut her Achilles tendons not because of some strange murderous ritual, but to prevent further rigor mortis and to aid in his sexual acts with the body. He spoke of his childhood, too, not in a way that would allow him to use it to avoid responsibility for the killings, but with a sense of wonderment at what he had experienced. It had not been until his years at Atascadero that he had first begun to realize that the climate in his mother's orbit was abnormal. He was really just recovering when he had been released by the California Youth Authority and plunged back into the cauldron. I asked Kemper whether he had committed any sexual acts with his mother's body after he killed her, and he glared at me and said that he had humiliated her corpse. He understood that even though he had killed the source of his problems, he was not relieved of them, and would never be fit for life in the outside world again. Equally important, he told me that his fantasies drove these killings, that as time went on, during the months that he was murdering, the fantasies became more and more intricate, as well as intense. Nonetheless, in the course of the murders, there was always some detail that didn't happen as planned, or that he felt could have been more perfect. That imperfection pushed him to kill the next time. The actual act of murder, Kemper concluded, was never as good as the fantasy, and never would be. In 1988, during the satellite broadcast, Kemper and Gacy behaved pretty much as I expected they would. Kemper was totally candid about his crimes, admitting everything, going into gory detail at times, and giving quite a bit of psychological insight into the role that fantasy had played in his murders. His perspective was revelatory to many in the audience. In some ways, Kemper's detailed memories and explanations of his acts were a demonstration of the need to keep even such heinous murderers alive. I believe they should not be executed, but rather imprisoned and counseled, so we can learn from them what we may do to prevent other would-be murderers from following their paths. Executions of such men do not serve any socially useful purpose. They do not deter other would-be serial killers who are so caught up in their own fantasies that the possibility of being caught and killed themselves does not sway them from their crimes. And actually, executions don't even save the state money, because to kill a prisoner today requires millions of dollars in legal expenses. It's more useful to keep a man such as Ed Kemper alive so we can study him. John Gacy used his 90 minutes to try to persuade the watching audience of law enforcement officials that he was innocent of the crimes for which he had been convicted, and that they, as police experts, should pursue the loose ends and lost witnesses and make it their business to overturn his conviction and see to it that he was set free. An appeal is actually in process for Gacy, and a ruling is expected shortly. Some audience members later were annoyed at me for not verbally pinning Gacy to the wall during that broadcast, for not forcing him to admit his crimes to our forum. I tried to explain that this would have served no real purpose, and that my goal had been to let each of these murderers display his personality for the audience, so that, for instance, they could see for themselves Gacy's perspective, the way he now denied everything, the extent of his brilliance at manipulation. Some still didn't comprehend the point, but I guess that's why we need to have more seminars and continuing education about homicide and the minds of multiple murderers. 12. Broader Horizons. From the time of the formation of the BSU to the present, publicity has been a two-edged sword for those of us in the unit, and I've always had it swirling around me. The uproar began back in the era when I was becoming the senior profiler, taking over from Teton and Mullaney. I was training hostage negotiators in Chicago. Patricia Leeds, a veteran police beat reporter in Chicago, was attending the classes in preparation for writing an article on hostage negotiation. We talked, and I mentioned my interest in William Herons, whose case she knew very well. She soon wanted to visit Quantico and prepare an article about profiling and violent crime. I checked with my superior at Quantico and with the Public Affairs Division and got a sort of half-approval for her to come down and interview me and others in the BSU for such an article. Pat arrived and spent a day, and at the end of it wanted to stay for a second day. One prerogative that agents at Quantico have is to allow guests to stay overnight in special guest rooms, so I booked her into one of those. In the evening, we were chatting in the beer hall with several Chicago police officers who were at Quantico for a three-month period. It was late, and I wanted to go home, so I asked the Chicago men if they would escort Pat back to her room when they were finished with their beers and conversation. As fate, or the sort of luck I seemed to attract, would have it, Pat was spotted in the beer hall without her agent escort by someone who knew her. He was John Otto, recently elevated to deputy director of the bureau, and who had formerly been the SAC of the Chicago office. Otto was passing through in the company of a covey of other bureau big shots, including Director Webster and Ken Joseph, then in charge at Quantico. Joseph was annoyed because a guest was loose at the academy and had no agent escort. In the morning, Joseph confronted the academy's public affairs officer, who claimed he didn't know what a police reporter was doing at Quantico, nor why she had been allowed to roam around without supervision. By the time I arrived for the day, Joseph was in a state of panic. Who knew what this demon reporter might write about Quantico? What if she wrote about police officers drinking beer on FBI property? About FBI agents whose white shirts were not properly starched? Clearly, there was some reason to believe that J. Edgar Hoover's ghost really did haunt the halls at Quantico. Let's not play what-if games, I told Joseph as I sat in his office and listened to this speculation. This was a friendly reporter, engaged in research for what I was certain was going to be a positive article. Moreover, I had checked with my superior and with public affairs before allowing her to come to Quantico. If the article came out and it was negative, I said, there would be plenty of reason and time to rake me over the coals. Until that eventuality, however, I considered his panic to be unwarranted. As a good friend, Ken Joseph gave way to my view on this matter, but as I left his office, I knew I owed him a favor. Pat Leeds' front-page article in the Chicago Tribune on February 15, 1980, was entitled, "They Study the Strangest of Slayings," with the subhead, "Little Known FBI Unit Profiles Bizarre Killers." It was as accurate and as flattering as anybody could have wished, and I heard no more paranoid rumblings about unescorted reporters at the academy. The article was picked up by the wire services and reprinted in many other newspapers, and it led to a flood of other articles, including important ones in the New York Times, People, and Psychology Today, just to name a few, as well as invitations for me to appear on various television and radio programs. Interest was high because the BSU was unique in law enforcement at the time. Both Los Angeles and New York City had psychologists working for their police departments, but these men did not regularly profile criminals as we were doing. Another part of outreach that I pioneered, much more deliberately than the publicity effort, was to the psychiatric and mental health communities. My outreach to psychiatry was part of an overall thrust of mine to go beyond the bounds of what had traditionally been the purview of the FBI and to link up with mental health professionals. I started doing so in the mid-1970s and have kept it up since then. I certainly felt I could learn something from psychiatrists, psychologists, and other professionals involved in mental health, forensic sciences, prison work, and the like. And many of the mental health associations in particular were delighted to have a participant from the FBI at their gatherings. Invariably, when I appeared on a program as a representative of the FBI, there was a full house. I found that the difference between presenting information about our work to a law enforcement audience and to a room full of psychiatrists was that the police personnel generally sat, watched, and listened, often with arms folded, almost challenging me to tell them something they didn't already know, while the psychiatrists, perhaps because of their many years of attending classes, invariably took copious notes. An early key incident in my outreach to psychiatry happened when, at a psychiatric conference, I presented the case of Monty Rissell. This case had fascinated me since I first learned about it, principally because, had I profiled the unknown rapist and murderer at the time of the crimes, I would have guessed wrong. The number and magnitude of his crimes suggested to me a man in his late 20s or early 30s. If I'd said or written that to the Alexandria, Virginia police when Rissell was still at large, they would have pursued the wrong sort of suspect. Given what I had come to know of the minds of murderers, I would have believed it improbable that someone still in his teens had been capable of committing a dozen rapes, of which in the last five the victims were also murdered. But that's what Rissell had done. As a researcher, I had learned to look long and hard at information that challenges preconceptions, including the data about Monty Rissell. Rissell's problems had begun at the same young age as those of many of the offenders sketched earlier in this book, and he had a similar dysfunctional family, but everything else about him seemed to have been accelerated. He began raping women when he was 14. Convicted, he was sent to a psychiatric facility in Florida and committed five more rapes during the time he was technically in the charge of that facility. One while on vacation, another during a runaway episode, and others while he was actually living in the institution, in the facility's parking lot, at a public swimming pool, and the like. 3 weeks after coming home from the psychiatric facility, Rissell was charged with an attempted armed robbery that was actually an intended rape. This charge would take a year to work through the courts, and during that time, the judge assigned him to report regularly to a psychiatrist. Unfortunately, this psychiatrist's practice did not normally include violent juvenile offenders. Rissell saw the psychiatrist on a regular basis, and, according to the psychiatrist's reports, made good progress. The progress was an illusion. During this year in which he was receiving treatment, Rissell, for the first time, murdered one of his rape victims. The crime took place in the vicinity of the apartment complex where he lived. When the year-old attempted robbery case came to trial, Rissell was convicted and sentenced to probation and continued psychiatric counseling. No one at the time of the robbery conviction had traced the murder to him or even suspected his involvement. During his probationary period, while still seeing the psychiatrist, Rissell committed four more rape murders near the apartment complex. There seemed no true pattern to the crimes. The rape victims differed. Some were young, others were in their 30s, some were white, others black, some were single, some married. The police continued to look for an outsider, and Rissell's arrest for these crimes came not as a result of a logical trail leading to his door, but rather from a chance search of his car. He confessed to the murders, was convicted, and given 5 life sentences. It was only after spending 2 years in prison that he told the authorities about the earlier rapes that he had committed while living in the psychiatric facility. I interviewed Rissell in prison and found him to be quite articulate and forthcoming about his crimes, able to give considerable detail about his motivations and state of mind, and to trace these to roots in his childhood. He agreed to become part of our criminal personality research project and provided very good data for us. For instance, he recounted that he had let one rape victim go. He had not killed her because she told him that she had to support a member of her family who had cancer. A member of Rissell's family also had cancer, so he let his victim live. In our terms, he had become personally involved with the victim to such a large degree that he could no longer depersonalize her and kill her. This sort of information on Rissell is what I was recounting to a forensic psychiatric group in Chicago in the early 1980s. With Rissell's mugshots on the screen, I was lecturing to an audience of 80 or so mental health professionals about the case. I was facing the door, and through it, I saw a scene that seemed as if it were out of an animated cartoon. A man walked by the door, peered in, and kept going. Then his head came back into the frame, as it were, to look again, and the rest of the body followed. The man came into the lecture hall and took a seat down front near the lectern. He proceeded to watch and listen with rapt attention as I went on with my presentation. During it, I mentioned that Rissell had been seeing a psychiatrist during the time that he was raping and murdering, and that the psychiatrist had not realized that Rissell was lying through his teeth in order to get the doctor to award him a diagnosis of good progress. This, I suggested, was testimony to the manipulative genius of organized murderers. In my view, the problem stemmed from the historic reliance of traditional psychiatry on self-report. That is, that the patient will truthfully tell the doctor everything that has happened and will willingly participate in the healing process. Forensic psychiatry has learned not to rely solely on self-reports, to use outside reports, court records and the like, and to continually question the accuracy of what a patient offender discloses about his life and actions. During my presentation, the man who had come in and sat down was sweating profusely, beginning to look ashen. At the end of my lecture, the lights went on and people started to file out of the room. The sweating, white-faced, obviously troubled man came up and said he had to talk to me. "I'm a psychiatrist," he said. "You look like you need a psychiatrist," I retorted. "I'm Dr. Richard Ratner," he said. "I'm the guy who was gulled by Monty Rissell. I've agonized over this case for many years. Can we talk?" To condense a long story, we did talk, and we became friends. I reiterated my contention that he had been fooled by Rissell in much the same way as Rissell's rape and murder victims had, and that he should not blame himself too greatly for that. I went on to urge that in his future forensic work, it was imperative that he not rely completely on the self-reports of his patients' offenders. In recent years, Dr. Ratner has become an active convert to this idea. Still disturbed by the notion that if he had been more astute in the Rissell case, the lives of several people might have been spared, Dr. Ratner lectures to groups and uses himself as an example of a man who was duped by a master manipulator. He has invited me to make grand rounds and psychiatry presentations at various hospitals in the Washington, D.C. area. I've brought him in to Quantico as a guest lecturer, and he has become an advisor to the Criminal Personality Research Project. Of such bonds, one hopes, progress is made in the understanding of the criminal mind. I had been presenting to psychiatrists for some years when a second important incident occurred. It was at a similar gathering, and I was speaking about what I had come to label regressive necrophilia. I had on the screen a crime scene slide of a woman from whose vagina one could see a tree branch protruding. I explained that the term regressive necrophilia had been used to describe the insertion of foreign objects into the vagina or anus, something we had observed in cases involving seriously disorganized offenders. We interpreted it as an act that displayed tremendous hostility toward women and, at the same time, the offender's ignorance of consensual sexuality. It is an act that is often misinterpreted by crime scene analysts as a mutilation, when it is actually a sexual substitution. One man in the audience, a non-forensic psychiatrist with silver hair, objected vociferously to the slide and to my presentation of the whole subject. He accused me of trying to shock the audience and insisted that this had to be a most unusual case and that there had never been another like it. He interrupted the lecture to the point that I had to address him directly before I could continue. I asked the man how many crime scenes he had ever evaluated. "None," he said. "I'm a psychiatrist, not a police officer." I stood my ground, saying that we had seen similar behavior in dozens of cases. He continued to say that this was absurd. Another member of the audience asked the protester to sit down and listen and said that if he did, perhaps everyone might learn something. The protester could not be appeased, however, and stomped out. Later, other members of the audience suggested to me that he had been on overload, that he was too set in his ways to assimilate new information. They had found the presentation instructive, they said, and, in general, I've had the same positive reaction from the dozens of professional groups to whom I've spoken in the last 15 or so years. In the fall of 1991, my attempts to bridge to the psychiatric community were acknowledged when the American Academy of Psychiatry and the Law honored me at their annual conference in Orlando, Florida, with its annual Amicus Award, given to the person who, as an outsider to the field of psychiatry, has done the most to advance its knowledge. No other FBI agent has ever been considered for this award. From the beginning of my years at Quantico, I was determined that our work would be a two-way street, not one way, as had been the norm in the old FBI. Toward that end, I was constantly on the lookout to bring people who could help us to the FBI. Dr. Murray Myron, an expert in psycholinguistics, had been brought in as a bureau consultant by Pat Mullaney. My mentors, Mullaney and Teton, had also been instrumental in developing people within the bureau who could assist hypnosis experts, whom we sometimes employed to help witnesses recall in more vivid detail what they had seen in relation to a crime. I reached out to various forensic psychiatrists, such as Drs. Park Dietz, James Cavanaugh, Richard Ratner, Robert Simon, and others, and, for my criminal personality research project, to Dr. Ann Burgess, and to such advisors as Dr. Marvin Wolfgang of the University of Pennsylvania, who had done pioneering studies of violent offenders. A good deal of my time was spent in lecturing to in-service agents and to the police who came to Quantico for courses. And for these courses, I always sought outside guest lecturers. Burgess, Dietz, and the others just mentioned came and spoke, as did Captain Frank Boltz, who had practically invented hostage negotiation for the New York City Police Department. I had noticed that no matter how lively our own presentations were, it was these guest lecturers who became the main topic of students' reports back to their superiors. I went far beyond law enforcement and forensic sciences to find interesting guests. A friend had told me that the patient in the Three Faces of Eve case, Chris Sizemore, had recovered from the multiple personality disorder that had been the basis for a celebrated book and for a movie starring Joanne Woodward, and had become a dynamite lecturer. I met Chris and determined to have her come to Quantico. The Bureau's general, though unwritten, rule was that you checked such things as unusual lecture guests with your superior. That superior invariably would not object, but would inform the agent that he would be acting on his own, and that if anything went wrong, it would be the agent, not the superior, who would face the wrath of the Bureau. I got that standard line from my boss, and more in addition. Wasn't this woman a mental patient? I told him she was fully recovered and not dangerous. He told me it was my rear end on the line, not his. With a deadpan face, I told him that the greatest difficulty with Chris was that, since she had three personalities, we'd have to triple our regular honorarium in order to obtain her. He didn't get the joke. Chris was a big hit, explaining what it was like to have a mental disorder and to recover from it. There had been several headline courtroom cases in which the defense had tried to invoke a defense that involved multiple personalities. Chris spoke convincingly to the effect that if one of a patient's multiple personalities is capable of murder, all are, and that if one is not, neither are the others. In summary, she said that having multiple personalities did not exculpate a murder suspect. All of the guests contributed in some special way to our growing expertise. Other unusual visiting lecturers included a sculptor, Frank Bender, who specializes in constructing models that show what a suspect might look like after not having been seen in 10 or 20 years, and a psychic, Noreen Rainier. This woman had been well recommended to me and had previously worked on some cases with local law enforcement entities, helping to locate dead bodies and providing similar clues. My superior told me that I was to tell our students that we were just presenting Rainier as an interesting lecturer, not recommending her to local police departments or in any way suggesting that we believed in what she was doing. She came to Quantico early in 1981. And in her lecture, she told us that she was not in control of her powers, that they were sometimes on target and sometimes not. In front of a group of policemen that day, Rainier predicted that an attempted assassination of President Ronald Reagan would take place before the end of the month. She said that the president would be hit in the left chest, that he would not die but would recover, gain a great deal of sympathy from the public, and go on to greater things. After Reagan was shot, I asked the psychic down for a second appearance at Quantico, and this time she predicted that the president would die in an assassination attempt in November at the hands of men in foreign uniforms wielding machine guns. This time I told the Secret Service about her predictions. They were upset that I hadn't brought them the first prediction, which I had initially thought was just a wild guess. She was both right and wrong about the November assassination. It was President Sadat of Egypt who died in October, not November, at the hands of men in foreign uniforms with machine guns. In another instance, she helped locate a plane containing the body of a relative of an FBI agent. The psychic also predicted something in my own life. Several days before I was scheduled to leave on a 6-week trip to Germany, she told me that I would be coming back shortly because of something having to do with a dark-haired woman. 3 days after I landed in Germany, I was called back to the States because my wife, who had dark hair, had been in a terrible automobile accident. By this time, however, information that Rainier had lectured at Quantico had gotten out to the media, where it was distorted into a story that announced flatly that the psychic was an FBI consultant. A second story twisted the facts still further, saying that this psychic had been hired by the FBI to predict such things as assassination attempts. The Quantico authorities were incensed at this and forbade me to invite Rainier to lecture again. A year or two later, we were confronted with a murder case that had happened right on the Quantico base to the wife of a DEA agent, a case that had us stumped for a long time. While we were still perplexed by it, my superior, a novice to the BSU unit, came to me and asked whether I could invite the psychic down to lecture once more so he could consult with her and see whether she could help on this murder case. I objected, reminding him that I had been told by higher brass that we were not to use her anymore. He insisted that I bring her down anyway and agreed to take the heat if her presence became known. After her lecture, he whisked her out of the classroom and allowed her to see and touch the evidence associated with the case, but her input had no bearing on the case, which remains unsolved to this day. Even though the sort of publicity that Noreen Rainier had involved us in was not of the best sort, the BSU continued to be the focus of outside interest. Early in the 1980s, that interest changed from documenting what we did to using it as the basis for fiction. Writers of articles, and even more so of fiction, often expand in their work the idea of what the FBI can accomplish through profiling. They make profiling seem like a magic wand that, when available to police, instantly solves the crime. As listeners of this book will know by now, magic has nothing to do with it. Profiling is merely the application of sound behavioral science principles.